What I was saying is that it's a particular pleasure for me to welcome you to this discussion, a conversation between Naomi Younger and Judith Febbery, to a topic dear to their and to my own hearts. What does it mean to be a creative figure in our contemporary world? What is the relation, collaborative artistic activity, to solitary composition? Is the tension between tradition and modernity a restrictive or an energizing tension? And who better to talk about this than two friends who meet regularly to discuss such topics and about our political and social context and the creative ideas and endeavors which emerge from or wither in our national space. Judith is the Executive Director of the Democracy and Governance Unit at the HSRC, although she's just about to join the Institute of Security Studies. Prior to this, she was head of EDASA's Political Information and Monitoring Service. Her interests focus on good governance and transparency and the law as a tool for advocacy, as well as other aspects of national legal and political life, interests which generate her highly regarded columns and commentaries, as well as her research. There are many things to say about her work, her fellowships and awards, but for our purposes today, you also need to know that she has an intense interest in art, music, literature, and cultural life generally. And not content with her degrees in law, which are many, she has started a PhD on patronage in the late Roman Republic, with special reference to the works of Cicero. So if she gets a little rhetorical, or if she asks some questions in Latin, and Neo answers in Italian, because he studied in Trieste, you will know why. Neo's contributions to SA cultural life as a composer, librettist, musician, and cultural commentator are legion, and I shall only mention a few elements of his amazingly energetic creative life. He co-curates the Pan-African Space Station, is a member of the curatorial team for the Cape Town World Design Capital Campaign, is a fellow of the Aspen Global Leadership Initiative, and is a research fellow at the Center for Humanities Research at UWC. He's just been awarded a Wiser Duke University 6-month writing fellowship for a creative artist who usually works outside a university environment. Born into a creative family, a family of musicians and makers of the Mozambican timbila, the precursor to the marimba, his knowledge of African musical forms, combined with his studies of Western Italian madrigals and other elements of the Western classical tradition, have resulted in a range of compositions fusing those traditions and placing him at the forefront of the South African avant-garde. His innovative operetta, The Flower of Shembe, is a landmark piece. His cantata profana, based on a poem by Anki Kroff, is both radical and moving. And his recent collaboration with William Kentridge exhibits what I think of as a unique combination of Dada disruptive energy, lyrical depth, and pure sweetness. He's currently engaged in studying that key symbolic text, Inkosi Sikelele Afrika, as well as other liberation songs. All his work is infused with the quest to understand the relation of aesthetics to political life and the life of the citizen, to the vexed issue of African identity, and to fascinating technical and philosophical questions, for instance, about the relationship between language, song, dance, ethics, and image. We look forward to eavesdropping on their conversation. I sometimes join them at their lunches, and so I'm particularly pleased in my last year of summer school to be able to eavesdrop again. Judith will chair and take questions from the floor at the end, in the last 10 minutes. Naya's going to show a few clips towards the end, but the questions please hold till the end. So please welcome Judith and Naya.
Well, thanks very much, Ingrid, for that, as usual, on-point and word-perfect introduction. So Naya and I have lots to live up to. Naya, I want to Well, firstly, it is a pleasure for me to welcome you all here today, and also a specific pleasure for me to be in conversation with Neo. Ingrid described Neo as a composer, librettist, and a musician, but we're privileged to call him a friend as well, and so it really is wonderful to be here. Neo, I want to start off with your journey, your early journey and your early life in Soweto growing up. And you describe yourself as a child growing up surrounded by myth and by song, and that you imagine yourself as the child of the Chopi master musicians, the inventors of the timbila, as Ingrid has described, at Mozambique, and the Shembe clan of KwaZulu-Natal. But I want to hear a little bit from you about what those early imaginings were. Growing up in the township of Soweto, having this sort of mystical, mythical influence, but then also, on the other hand, as a child being beaten by police and having the harshness of that environment imposed on you. And how did those two things hold together for you?
Well, my grandfather, my father's father, came from a province in Mozambique called Nyamban. And he left when he was a child. He left when he was 14, and he came to work on the mines in South Africa. The story is he walked across the border and found himself a job, educated himself, and then found a partner, my grandmother, and they created a family and started creating businesses. My grandfather was quite a maverick, I think, and a big storyteller. So often the stories he would tell us centered around these two myths that he set up for the family. One was that our family invented magic, and the second was that our family invented music. And the music was because the Muyanga clan, for a long time, for three or four generations, have been makers of the mbila, which they tune by shaping a piece of wood. And the tuning always goes according to family relations. So if you know your stuff by hearing a whole instrument, you might actually be able to tell who made it. At what point in the past. So it's quite an incredible stretch back to that way of making music. I don't know that anybody in South Africa in my family is a professional musician. I'm the first in my family. But of course it took my family many years to kind of have respect for me being a professional musician. I'd been a professional musician. I'd been a professional musician already for about, I think, 10 years or so. And my mother read an article in a local newspaper that said something very nice about something that I'd done. And she said, oh, you know, this is very good. One day you'll be professional. So it was always that story. So the music was always part of growing up. Everybody sang. Not many people played instruments, but everybody certainly sang. And yes, the relationship with the police, I think, was, I hope, not personal. It was during the state of emergency, 84, 85, I wasn't a very street-smart kid, let's say. I didn't grow up playing in the street. And on this one particular occasion, on the 16th of June in 84, for some reason, we were let out of the yard. So I went to visit my grandmother's house. My mother grew up one street away from my father. My family is all about efficiency and boxes. So my father went up one street to find a wife. I went one street up to find my grandmother. And some kids were playing in the street. And they heard a sound. There was tear gas in the air. As we all know, the 16th of June in those days was always full of tear gas and police, hippos, and all of that. I didn't know the sound, so when the other kids heard it and they ran, I waited because I wanted to see what the thing was they were running from. So, by the time I saw it, of course they'd seen me, and so they beat me quite badly, actually. But I think they did me a favor. I think something happened in my brain. They kind of switched my wiring so that now I can do things that I probably couldn't do before.
But just to back to that, and you talk about, I mean, I'm interested in your early imagination in that environment.
Yeah.
I mean, it was obviously there were musical instruments, and you say that you were surrounded by myth and song, and so African myth, presumably, but yeah. Given your later work, it's clearly influenced by various other forms, let's say Greek myth. How did that come about? Where did that start? What were your earliest imaginings of creating?
I didn't, until very late in my life, I didn't see myself as a creative person. My great love is physics. I was always going to be I was always going to be a theoretical physicist. And so I didn't want to go into the arts or to music because I thought, why study something that is so naturally ingrained? So I went and I tried to learn all kinds of other things. I think the mythology was always a part of me, and it was something that I only interrogated once I started asking professional questions around how to tell certain stories. So the myths around creation, myths around the Messiah personality, of course, transcend culture. Each culture seems to have these stories that one tells about how the world was made, about the Savior coming or the Savior just gone. I don't know that I was so aware of them as a child. I really began interrogating them when I started seeing myself as a storyteller.
So you would describe it as a sort of subconscious, in a way, a subconscious exposure to these sorts of elements of myth and song.
Yes, I think I was brought up by people who could tell stories very well. I was a very quiet kid, I think, and so I didn't speak. I spent a lot of time listening to people tell stories, and lots of people told lots of tall stories.
Mm-hmm. When I was growing up.
And part of my life was spent growing up in Botswana in a rural village called Pitsane. And there people would tell all kinds of stories about the creation of certain instruments. There were choral competitions every December that I used to be really fascinated by, and I would watch every year. They weren't competitions as such, because no one ever won or lost anything. It was just a moment for people to perform for one another and kind of show off their uniforms. But I think in all of these stories, people telling tales about where the Tswana language came from, where the Basotho were seeking to protect themselves against the colonizing imperialistic forces of Shaka Zulu, the Fingane stories that we heard at school, all of those things I think stayed in my head. The idea about the creation of these different tribes and these different groupings. The fact that my mother, who's Zulu, comes from a family called the Shembe. And Shembe is considered a Jesus-like figure in a certain part of this country, because he had a kind of mosaic experience. He went up a mountain, Ebuhleni. He claims to have spoken to God, and God directed him at founding a church around 1910. This has now become one of the most important, not just religious, but also financial movements in South Africa. It's the church of the voiceless, the church of the disenfranchised, the illiterate. But the reports are that they are worth about 3 billion rand invested in the stock exchange. They've got the most sophisticated legal system that kind of protects all their patent creations. They recently threatened to sue FIFA during the World Cup.
Yes.
And FIFA conveniently shipped them off to the manufacturers of the Vuvuzela they're claiming to make. And apparently now the story is they own 10% royalty on every Vuvuzela made.
So they're very wealthy. But I suppose given Bafana's fortunes, maybe not. But how does one... So you're saying that it's something which, to learn to see the world lyrically, is something which simply came to you, and it was a mixture of that and some form of study, in a sense.
The way my mind works is boringly technical. I like to look at the architecture of...
Somehow I don't believe that.
No, I know it doesn't come across like that. We always have this argument, but it's true. Yeah. It's really true. I like to understand how things are made. So I like to understand what the architecture is that keeps... Say again? Yes. The idea of finding what the blueprint is that allows a piece of music or a building or a dance piece to function. And if I can understand that, then hopefully to be able to recreate it or mix it with something else. So I think in a way, because of my interest in science... which is how I felt as a child.
Yes.
I was interested in what made the world work. And only later did I transfer that kind of thinking to how I make music or storytelling or painting.
Okay, so I mean that's interesting. We'll get back to that later. But I read somewhere that you imagine yourself as a 14th century inhabitant walking the streets in Cape Town, and I thought that was rather a unique way of describing oneself. What is it that you see?
Well, that quote is really particularly to do with.
Don't say that you know they misquoted you.
No. I did say it was a little bit of a joke. I was just digging a little bit. My interest, my area of study in Italy was madrigals,
yes.
Which are kind of 14th century style of singing, and there's a particular outlook in that kind of storytelling, the kind of part singing that everybody has their own counterpoint. But together we make a kind of harmony that kind of comes out of magically chords. You know, the way music works is both vertically and
horizontally.
And the horizontal is what people call the chord. So the horizontal is what each voice does if we're all making a lot of noise in the room. But if we all were to stop at certain definitive moments together, that would be creating this horizontal mark that ties the top vertical to the subsequent ones. In a sense, madrigals work like that, and I was just expressing how my perception of music was like that.
Yeah, it's quite a lot. But going to the madrigal tradition, so you then decide, so your life's rather peppered with the unusual, I think, because this person from Soweto, and then you go off to Trieste and to study the madrigal tradition and physics. It's a rather odd combination. It's not really a natural progression in a sense, but some of what you've said has described that. So to what do you ascribe that? That's sort of some part of the imagined world of your childhood takes you to the madrigal tradition.
You know, when science first occurred to our species, the human race, it was called natural philosophy, and it was taught by the Egyptians, who then taught it to the Greeks as natural philosophy, and they had three departments. It was music, it was philosophy, and it was what we regard today as science. So the art of measuring and analyzing. So in a way, part of my affectation, part of my delusion about the 14th century is that my brain still works in that way. I still find it perfectly logical to connect history to empirical evidence to this idea of creating something that is beautiful, possibly also religious and uplifting. So they live together in my head. So I don't have these boxes or categories.
So in a way, it is a kind of natural progression for you to end up in Trieste. But I want to take you back, and you talk about as well your interaction as a child in Soweto with Gibson Kente, who visits your school. And that must have been an extraordinary exposure, in a sense, to somebody who you know is so famous in terms of writing and recording and township life. What impact did that have on you today and on yourself at that age,
yeah.
as a young man?
Well, it was an incredible thing. I mean, I think.
Tell us a bit about that. How did that come about?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you? He comes to your school and.
He happened to be a close friend of the headmistress at my school in Dube, where I used to go. Ngatundu. And Dube village is where all the black intelligentsia lived at a certain point. Richard Maponya lived there, Dr. Mutlana lived there, Gibson Kente lived there and worked and workshopped a lot of his pieces there. And we were doing a play at school. And I think my headmistress very abusively asked Brakib to come and coach us or give us some pointers about drama and storytelling. I mean, these are all things that only later in life do I recognize the significance of them. I think at the time, I just thought, here's an old guy who's coming to show us how to act. I can do that.
It was only father of black theater.
Absolutely. It was only later that I realized actually the connection to what I was taught then to what I'm interested in now. And only then did I start going back and studying some of the work that he did. And the fact that he created some of the first manifestations of a township theatre aesthetic, which I've now taken as part of my great influence in creating the productions that I'm interested in creating. So that was a big story. It wasn't a big story at the time. We just delivered a school play.
Looking back, you see the significance of that.
Looking back, I mean, I can go even further back. Mm-hmm. I don't always remember a lot of my childhood, but there's certain key things, and one of them was that apparently when I was four, I used to invite both sets of grandparents to the house. What I do remember is having a Jimmy Cliff, the Big Mountain record, and apparently I used to know both sides. I would perform for my grandparents. I didn't regard myself as a performer in my teenage years. I was a very kind of awkward teenager. But apparently when I was younger, I was very flamboyant, and I would do spins, and I had a microphone, and I would perform the whole first half, and then I would turn the LP myself, and then perform the second half. And then I would tell them to come back next Sunday, the same time, exactly the same show. And we did it for years.
You're not going to do that now, are you?
No, I don't do that anymore.
that's a pity, actually. But so you seem to be quite at home in, of course, mixing the African and the European traditions. How important was being that experience in Italy in terms of influencing you into that sort of collaborative work?
I think it was a hugely influential thing. I left for Italy just before my 16th birthday. I was in matric, and the college was starting in September. So I
was very young.
Yeah, I was quite young. Yes. So that experience really shaped a lot of who I became. Mm-hmm. I have a love-hate relationship with Italy.
Talk a little bit about that.
Well, Italy is not known for its open-minded, welcoming human rights record, let's say. They've got a huge problem with perceptions of the other, the foreigner, the Moors, the idea of Il Morone, which in the south, the southerners are called the Moors by the northerners who are Germanic. And when I got there, it was very strange or unexpected for a lot of people to find a black person who could speak Italian. I learned to speak with a very pompous Italian accent. So on the phone, I sound like a very nice, suited individual, but on meeting people, I would always get into trouble.
They're a little shocked.
Yeah, and I because lots of us, at the time, it was a strange experience because we had to get what's called a permesso di soggiorno, which is a permit to stay for the study. And everyone had to carry it with them. All the foreign students who look foreign had to carry it with them all the time. So inevitably, I would end up at the local police station trying to negotiate for the release of my Sotho colleague or my Swazi colleague who had been out for the night and didn't carry the pass, actually. So I left South Africa to go carry
pass.
And,
so that obviously influences the way you see things. But then you come back, and what happens then? I want to take us into the Black Sunshine phase.
Okay. Well, there's a whole chunk in the middle.
Yes.
So I finished college in Italy, realized that I'm not ready yet to study further. I'd gotten into Edinburgh University, but had no money to pay for myself, so I thought I'll take some time and raise money in England. And I knew of a company, a theatre company in England called Footprints. So I went and I worked for them. So actually, this is the beginning of my storytelling phase. So from having done madrigals and science at college, I then ended up working for a theatre troupe. And I'm a terrible actor, as lots of my good friends will tell you. So they said, you can't act, but you can make music for our productions. So I started then writing material for plays, and I really, I think, got the bug then to be able to tell stories on the stage. And I was 19. I wasn't earning enough money to survive, so while I was there, at night I would work, I would freelance at the local BBC. I learned tape editing on the old reel-to-reel machines, mm-hmm. which really suited my kind of technical mind, idea of how you splice tape and make somebody say things that they never actually say. I really enjoyed that very much.
So you're being subversive.
That was great.
Yes.
That was great. I started then, as putting words in people's mouths. And then through those two experiences, I was interested in current affairs, news gathering, and storytelling. I came back to South Africa at the end of 94, very exciting time, also a very dangerous time in many ways. And I applied for a position, a part-time job at what was then 702 Radio, Prime Media Broadcasting. I was 20, 21, and I had signed up for a course at Rao University. So I could only do it part-time, I thought. And they said to me, we don't have a part-time job, but we'll give you a full-time job. You'll have to do hard news. So then I took that on when I came back here. So I did that during the day, studied at night, and still played my guitar and was making songs. And every now and then I'd go into open mic studios.
And then, so you get to Black Sunshine, which is probably how I got to know you in the first place, Neo, is at some place in Grahamstown watching you. And so acoustic pop, hip-hop, jazz, this kind of blend into African tunes. I mean, it seems to me as if that was about expanding music, really, in a way that that hadn't happened before in South Africa.
You know,
I've never, in that way.
Yeah, I've never done anything intending to change anything. I think I'm just a really lucky guy who just landed kind of feet
but
up.
But there's a collaboration in that. That seems to be, that formal collaboration that you have.
It was forced
there's a story in that.
It was forced upon me. I used to go to this open mic setup called Janitos in Yeovil. Living in Yeovil in the 90s was a kind of a wonderful, heady time. All the politicians lived around the corner. There was a lot of movement around the arts, creativity, a new identity, and so it was a wonderful thing to be part of in the world. And one of the people that I met at this place was Masauku Chibembere, who was born in America, but he's of Malawian parents, and he came here looking for a way to get back into his Southern African identity. And when we saw each other, we felt a resonance. And then he kept insisting, we must play together. The people say we must play together. So I said, okay, if the people say it, then we'll play together. So then we started playing together. In fact, it was a kind of work relationship. It wasn't, we became friends through the process of rehearsing.
But you say it was foisted upon you, but there's something in me which says that actually you dislike boundaries, and that even if you weren't intending to break boundaries, that you knew it was going in that direction.
I think, when I'll tell you how it feels from my point of view.
We can disagree.
Yeah, my father always says to me, you know, I'm so happy you make music, but why do you have to make such complicated music? And so often I try to make not so complicated music, and it comes out like it did in Black Sunshine. And then we were told, no, but
which the rest of
young
us
black men
yes.
can't play. It was the time of Kwaito. Yeah. So we were told you can't play acoustic, soul, funky, jazzy material because no one is going to listen or hear it. Except people somehow did, and we were very lucky to be able to sell some records and tour and met some really wonderful connections that helped us move to the next phases.
And do you think that was a precursor for your work on the Pan-African Space Station?
Absolutely. The connection for me also comes from childhood. Because I grew up as a child of a Mozambican family, a Zulu family, I grew up also being called Gwere Gwere, or outsider. Mm-hmm. And many of us did, in fact. So I was always present to this reality of the region being also home and not just South Africa. The idea that South Africa has been built by Malawians, Zimbabweans, Mozambicans, it was quite real as I grew up. So the Pan-African Space Station was in a sense trying to have that conversation on a musical level. The Pan-African Space Station was launched as a platform that hosts African cutting-edge music from the continent and from the diaspora. We were doing it on the internet, but we also wanted to have a physical manifestation, so we hosted a festival, a week's festival every year from 2008. 2008, which was the year of the so-called xenophobic attacks in May. And I do that in partnership with Chimurenga, who put out a journal, and it's a wonderful space for African thought and culture.
And the Pan-African Space Station are very much a part of the sort of cultural life of our city and the country. And so it seems like another boundary is being pushed there for you.
Again, the conversation about the Pan-African Space Station with me and my co-founder, Ntone Jabe, was because we both love music. He's a wonderful DJ who has a great collection of African music. And one day we were talking about who would we regard as avant-garde, as cutting-edge, as experimental in African music-making circles. We had a computer, so we Googled to see who was regarded as cutting-edge and experimental. Not a single African name came up, but we could think of a number of them. So we thought, well, maybe this is an opportunity for us to have this conversation and to illustrate it in a particular way, using music and not making speeches, but have music tell the story of pushing boundaries and how actually people have been doing this on this continent for a long time.
And they've been collaborating, of course.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think the collaboration is a big part of it. I was very aware, for example, that our big stars, people like Miriam Makeba, Hugh Masekela, all became politically mature outside in exile. They happened to be part of what was then King Kong, this production. This jazz poetry production that happened in 1959, which lands them in London. And while they're in London, they're told by the state they can no longer return because there are black people who left the country, and they've been talking a lot about the political scenario in the 60s. So they were out. And in that process of being exiled, they started learning about the power of music to play in the political space. So they changed our world from there through making music, then became accepted by the whole African continent as benefactors of a certain kind of being as an African. And then people like Hugh Masekela then meets James Brown and Fela Kuti in Los Angeles, and then he comes back to Lagos, to Nigeria, lives at the Shrine, and starts having a different kind of relationship to music making in Africa.
So that's interesting, because what you're describing and describing your growing up, it seems like that, you know, there is a passing of the baton here, and you see yourself as part of that.
I see
part
myself
of that history.
Yeah, I mean, I see myself as part of a 6,000-year history of notating music. You know, people in the Indian culture in Sanskrit were notating music 6,000 years ago, and it's that legacy that I take from and learn from. So in a sense, more than 14th century, I feel very much invested in how the paper, not so much recording is a really recent development, but the idea of being able to write and exchange notes has really shaped how I see the tribe I belong to, the composer's tribe. I mean, we can speak to one another quite easily. Last year I did a project with a Garifuna musician who was visiting Cape Town. And we had one rehearsal. I speak very bad Spanish. He speaks no English. We had one rehearsal with a band, and we put together an hour's worth of a program. And that was because we have a language, and we have kind of shorthand, testing one, two,
yes.
that we can do across language and across age. And that, for me, is a very big reason why I connect to this group.
So, one of your standout works was A Memory of How It Feels, and I remember seeing it in 2011, and it's a remarkable work and relies on myth, fairy tale, folklore, and this idea of a Zulu beaded love letter, and that each set you describe as an intimate conversation. And what is the role of the intimate in your work?
Theatre, I find, a making vulnerable of oneself. The idea of being on stage and having to identify with a character, or having to play an emotional song, very immediately takes away the mask that we put on when we're in society and we've got a job or a suit or a description that people accept. On stage, you kind of suddenly become this almost an oracle that everybody has expectations of. One part of it is something that you must satisfy, and the other is an opportunity to reveal that sense of the vulnerable in everyone who's watching. In theater school, when I first started working with theater directors, one of the first things they'd say is, when you go onto the stage and you're nervous, think of the whole audience, your audience, as all being in their underwear. and somehow
he's not doing that now.
Somehow so that brings an inner peace like you can't imagine, because there's nothing that you're exposing that you don't feel like you're sharing with your audience, and as a result you can feel incredibly personal. I can feel incredibly intimate in a very public environment, and only in that act of committing to the intimacy do you actually give a revelation that is interesting to the public. No one in the public is oblivious to what you know. I think we all have the same information. It's just the intimacy allows us to activate a certain electricity about it that allows people to come with us in imagining a new possibility.
And that transfers from the stage to whether you're doing Black Sunshine, Flower of Shemi, that transfers, doesn't it?
Well, with Black Sunshine, it took me a long time. I was a very awkward performer in Black Sunshine for the first 10 years, I would say. Partly because I'm an awkward person on stage, because I'm not used to being vulnerable in front of other people. And the second was because my partner, my founder, co-founder, was a very loud American who was very happy he was very happy to be the front and let me kind of play the back foil. And so it was a convenient kind of partnership for both of us. And it was only when I started doing separate work, solo work, but with this reputation of having been in Black Sunshine, people expected me to
do have that all the time.
To have a bigger presence on stage. So, okay.
So you disappointed them.
Sorry. But I had to learn how to do it.
But just going back to Memory of How It Feels and this collaboration, which is so powerful in all of your work, also with Ina Victorecht and Jazz Art.
Yes.
Where does that start in this long-standing relationship? Describe just a little bit of that process of working with Ina and putting something like that together, because it was extraordinary. It was the combination of music and then this really energetic dance.
Well, thank you. Ina Victor is a choreographer by training, dance and choreographer. She worked with Pina Bausch for many years in Wuppertal in Germany. So she comes with a kind of a store of great information. I mean, the Pina Bausch company has done really amazing work for many, many years and changed many lives. So she came to South Africa around the same time that I moved to Cape Town. We happened to both arrive here at the same time, 2002. And we lived in the same building. I came to Cape Town because I needed to leave Joburg because I found it too loud and I couldn't write. I didn't have quiet space enough for me to write. So I came looking for a small, minimalist environment that I could write and every now and then go out for coffee. Ina happened to be my neighbor. She's very loud. And it was very helpful having her, because I was a very kind of reclusive person who didn't really invite people over to my house ever.
So she dragged you out.
So no, Ina
came over.
Ina provided the space for me to invite people. If I was having a work meeting and I didn't want to meet outside of the cafe, Ina would provide the space for me to have my meetings or workshops. So I'd go next door to be the public person and I'd go home to be the private person. And for many years she did that, and then she introduced me to Jazz Art, where she was teaching and choreographing, and I began developing a relationship and a language with dancers, which wasn't too difficult because I'd had a similar impulse with actors. And so I established what's now become a kind of 10-year working relationship with Jazz Art. And so when we did Memory of How It Feels, the cast was, of course, musicians, but it also had lots of dance influence. The three of the cast members were storytellers who were also trained as dancers. And then Ina, who's the choreographer, directed the piece, making it kind of physically manifest in the theater.
And so, just moving on then to Flower of Shembe, because what an ambitious work, and described somewhere as an African fairy story in song and elastically pan-African, and drawing urban Zulu and modern chamber orchestra music together. And you call it music in a hybrid style. And you see, there again, I think there's that pushing of boundaries. But this relationship between tradition and modernity, it is also the theme of your work, isn't it?
Yeah.
And Flower of Shembe seems to bring that out quite subconsciously.
I've spoken to a number of people about the scheme before. I don't see myself as an individual. I don't think I exist as an individual. I think I'm a kind of a triangulation point of a past and a future. So I've got all these strands coming towards me. They kind of coalesce inside and then go forward and create all kinds of other illusions that we haven't seen yet or that I haven't seen yet. So all I do really is try to understand the different aspects of what's influenced and educated me. And in putting them together, somehow they come out in the way that they do. So yes, I don't see myself as belonging exclusively to this or that place. The struggle with...
So it's a hybrid place.
It is. Yeah. And the struggle with making pop music is that the expectation, and it's an expectation that's created by marketing,
that you stay in the
is,
same place.
What are you going to call it? Is it African music? Is it jazz? Is it this? And I, in the beginning, when I was younger, I'd be very offended, and I'd say, well, it doesn't have a label, it doesn't have a name, you know, it's free. That's not so clever, because it means you're not going to sell a single copy. So then we...
But in a way, it boxes you in, doesn't it? Which is just not who you are.
No, it's not who I am, but boxes are great for the public that I'm in conversation with. So then I started submitting to each of the boxes. So I would say to them, put me in African music, put me in jazz, put me in classical, put me in traditional, put me in, yeah. And whoever finds it, and we can have a conversation that clarifies things later.
So in Shembe, you say that the libretto came to you in your dreams. How do you what is that process of translating the dream into the reality, and what comes first, the libretto, the music?
The process of dream translation is you hope that you're as good as the dream sounded.
Yes. That you remember parts of the dream.
Yeah. But the conflict for me is nothing ever sounds as good. Mm-hmm. Nothing ever feels as right as it did in the dream. Mm-hmm. So the challenge is constantly to make it a prepared, worked, honed piece that feels organically able to grow and shape-shift. That you're able to learn from all the time. So the complex kind of equation to balance is how do you have this conversation with a set of other people who've got a set of very different training to you, but together we try to create a story that lives every night and refreshes itself and refreshes us.
And how do you do that?
Well, I found a trick. In 2009, I was commissioned to write music for the Royal Shakespeare Company's production of The Tempest, which started here. We toured the UK with it for 4 or 5 months. And I said to the company, I had a company of 8 musicians, and I said to them, we will play a game for 4 months. They were all dreading playing the same thing over and over. So I said, let's agree to play a game every night we perform. Is each one of us is allowed to make a deliberate mistake every night. And the person would be allocated so that the rest of us would know to listen for that. But often what happens is when the mistake happens, and it takes you slightly out of what you know happened last night, is you become disturbed, but also you listen a lot more attentively. And also what happened is it irritated the actors so much that every now and then they'd turn.
They'd be like, what's going on in the music?
Yeah, they would turn and they would do something that I felt brought electricity back into the performance. Yeah. So every single night, they were trying to get us to stop acting crazy, and we were trying to infuse a little bit of madness. And that's, I found, the only way to survive along that.
In Shembe, the central character is a girl posing as a boy. I mean, there's something of strong myth in that, and also a little bit of gender gendered issue in that. But because you describe yourself as a cultural activist, how important is it getting a message across? For example, a message around gender, or is that something you hope will happen by default, or is it something that you set out to do?
Yeah, what we've seen is it doesn't happen by default. I mean, we live on a continent that has just in Nigeria kind of outlawed being gay. And Uganda might do the same. And we've got people here who are beaten if they're wearing short skirts and offend people at taxi ranks. So I think one must, I don't know that I would call myself an activist, but I certainly believe in being active about the things that I believe. So the idea of posting our Messiah as a woman was really to question why messiahs are not women in any culture. The very few messianic cultures that have women as the heroic figure. And so without preaching, I think that's always not attractive. The idea was to try and present a different imagination. I think the place of art is to help us perceive slightly differently. So to imagine a different possibility for the future. So, I mean, they say that the basic needs of a human being are food and shelter. Well, I think imagination comes before food and shelter. Mm. Because without imagination, you can't make food or shelter.
That's fascinating. Is that the poverty? Do you see that there is a poverty of imagination in our society today?
I do. I think it's partly a political design question. South Africa, we must remember, comes from still many years of isolation. And in a way, the kinds of thinking that people have in South Africa are not particularly fluent when it comes to thoughts that people can have of what happens outside. I mean, I'm constantly asked by South Africans. I was playing, please don't ever ask me to play a New Year's gig. I played a New Year's gig this year for a very good friend. Because the trick was, he asked me to play it in May of last year. And so in May, it's easy to say, yeah, I'll do it.
Sure.
It's really easy. But one of the things that happened was, he's a very well-known journalist, Pulitzer Prize winning, and he wanted to explain and show off to his audience, who I think were asking, where's this music from and what kind of music is it? So he stopped the show and wanted to do an interrogation in the middle to ask me where the music is from. And I said to him, I know what this is about. The question is, we thought you said this guy comes from Soweto. This music doesn't sound like it comes from Soweto. Well, part of it does. Part of it is influenced by learning a lot of Ethiopian music, which I love. A lot of it is influenced by, yes, jazz music and classical music. And so the question of why a person like me would make the kind of music that I make doesn't occur in some societies. It occurs in this country because this country still has very clearly marked boxes for who is allowed to say and do what and act in what way. And if you transgress those, remember Zuma's quote about blacks and dogs?
Yes.
Or clever blacks?
Yes. White people and dogs. And blacks.
Yes. And we constantly trip over ourselves with that. And I don't think we're exceptional in that sense. I mean, I think the whole world, I just told you about Italy and how that's particularly conservative and close in a way. And I think all of human societies like that, which means that people who are pushing the boundary or at the vanguard are always seen as terrorists or counter-revolutionaries or witches or charlatans or you can think of all kinds of examples.
Yeah. So I'm watching the time, but I need to come back to you talk about this uncharted territory of African storytelling, and then you take on the most African of stories, the ultimate story, the life of Nelson Mandela, and you're working on an operetta collaboration on the life of Nelson Mandela. And how hard is that? Because the cynics might say, what new can be said or done with Mandela?
Yeah.
And in a way, you're touching myth.
I mean, look, that's exactly what I say. By the way, this is not an operetta, this is a full opera.
Yeah, yeah.
And when I signed up for it, it was a commission to write a new opera. I didn't sign on to write an opera on Mandela, actually. They kind of, again, foisted that on me. After the stories we were getting didn't kind of match the expectation. And so the libretto that we decided to work on was the story on the life of Nelson Mandela. And I very quickly felt, and I think the director agrees with me, and the company now agrees, that yes, we can't tell. If you're telling an epic story of born in Vezo, sent to Kuno, off to Johannesburg to become a lawyer, off to protest against passes, out as the Black Pimpernel, and then in Robben Island, and then out as president, and then in Houghton, as the statesman. I don't think that you can effectively tell anything that people haven't heard before.
And how do you prevent judgment as well?
I think there will always be judgment. I think to do what I do, everybody who's in my field, you learn after a certain point you have to grow thick skin. Because it's easy for people to criticize and to say, oh, that's not particularly good or that's not particularly true. I think the proposal that I'm making is my perception of the meaning of Mandela. And my device is to tell a story in the space of one day. So I'm not telling an epic story of beginning, middle, and end, which would put me in the space where the long walk to freedom has just been, which wouldn't be interesting. So I've really contracted it, and I'm telling one particular story and mythologizing that story. You know, when he left Robben Island, the story is the ANC was so young at the idea of taking charge and governing that there was a lack of preparation around security, safety, getting him from Victor Verster to Cape Town. And then getting him from Cape Town to Johannesburg was an even bigger hurdle. And so the question was, what car, what security? And they were offered security by the state, which they refused. And there was a moment where he was picked up from the prison and taken into town. And he was supposed to be going somewhere else and landed up eventually at City Hall. He wasn't meant to give the conversation, the speech at City Hall. That happened because Archbishop Tutu phoned and said, look, if you don't come here, we'll be in trouble because hundreds of thousands of people have descended.
Everyone's waiting.
And so he was quickly pulled in. But there was about an hour and a half where he was lost to his mind at the movement in between being taken from the prison to City Hall. So my story happens within that hour when he's lost.
In the hour that he's lost. The symbolism of that, I mean, if you think about works that have been written, The Cry of Winnie Mandela, for example, Djibril Ntibele's work, would you draw on that or think about sort of that kind of symbolism to mix it up with? Or does that make it just too complicated?
No, I draw on everything. Yeah. I mean, I think the thing I do very well is I sponge on everything. So research on the opera involved reading Long Walk to Freedom, reading conversations with myself, and reading the logs, diary logs, entries that he's left at the Center for Memory, Nelson Mandela Foundation. So in a sense, I think Nelson Mandela was very aware of being Nelson Mandela from very early on. He kept a record of almost everything, his weight in prison, his diseases in prison. I mean, it's all meticulously notated. So was the case with Winnie Mandela, her 491 days.
Yes.
I've also been reading that. Amina Kachalia's book, When Hope and History Align.
Yes.
So there are lots of material, and I've taken all of it in, and I've read Cry of Winnie Mandela and Mandela's book. Also, that's a big reference. So I spent 6 months reading, and then I closed myself off to do the writing for the following 6 months.
So, now, unfortunately, we're going to have to draw to a close here, but I want to ask two questions at the end. Firstly is, after an opera on Mandela and pushing these boundaries and working with William Kentridge, which we'll see a bit of later, what are the further boundaries that you think need to be pushed in South Africa and Africa? But Martha Graham said that being an actor, being an artist, is really you're in a constant state of dissatisfaction. You're blessed with this restlessness. And somebody else once described it as being on a monkey bar. Now, knowing that you, as Zen-like as you are, I can't imagine you feeling that your craft is like being on a monkey bar. But this idea of a blessed state of unrestfulness, I mean, do you feel that about your craft? Or do you look at Shembe and think, I nailed it?
No, I don't think...
About the arrogance.
I don't think there's ever nailing it. I mean, I see the mistakes. Mm. I see the intentions, like the dream.
Yes.
I see that intention, and I see how... I've got a friend, a professor of music at Stellenbosch, Stefanos Muller, and we have this conversation constantly about failing better. The idea is to fail better
at
what you do. So the journey, I think, is long. I'm really young at it. So I still have lots of questions, lots of things to unravel. Because I refer to people who are much older than me. I refer to material that came 100 years ago, 2, 3, 5. The comparison is how to match Puccini. I'm listening to, on the way driving here, listening to Puccini's Gianni Schicchi a lot, which is a very short, pithy opera. It's full of amazing things that I don't quite understand yet. And so the journey is how to get to a point where that becomes a natural part of my life, and then to find other, I mean, it's just one example, there are lots and lots of different things like that.
So really
I don't think I'm Zen like it, I think I just seem Zen, but I'm quite...
So it really isn't about the end of the journey, but just to wrap it up, Neowulp has did some fascinating work with William Kentridge last year, secondhand reading at the Goodman Gallery in New York City, and he has three clips that he is going to be playing for us and speaking quite briefly on them, and then we'll open the floor to some questions. We are at 2 o'clock, but we have some extra time. Thanks, Neo.
Thank you. This is Garth. He's going to help click on some of the pieces. So William Kentridge is, I'm sure everybody knows, is a wonderfully fascinating individual who makes work that I think is particularly important. And I've been a fan for many years, so when he called and said, let's do this together, it was quite fascinating. The process we engaged on was I'd go stay with him at his studio, and he works pretty much in the way that I work. So in the morning he's in the studio, takes lunch, and then goes back into the studio, goes and cooks dinner. Actually, I don't cook dinner, I wash dishes. He cooks dinner. And then after that, we go back into the studio. And the practice is, we'd find the idea that we thought worked, that was great. And then he'd say, okay, let's do it again, find another one. So we had three or four versions of a good idea on a particular machine or a particular artwork. And then we'd put it on the shelf and try and find a better articulation of it. So the result of these machines, he's got a team of people that manifest and articulate some of the ideas that he's got. And he wanted to play a game around naming things. So the idea of singers and the singer sewing machine of yesteryear. So these are before you play. So my training, before you play, one second. So before you play, so this is a sextet, because he said to me, so in your madrigal singing, what is the basic formation? And I said, well, if I was writing a basic madrigal, it would be for six voices. It would be for two high voices, soprani, two alto, and a tenor and a bass. And so he was talking about having these six machines. And they each have megaphones, and they are each divided like that. So two high voices, two slightly lower voices, and two male or bass voices. So this is a thank you. This is a video of an exhibition that opened at the Goodman Gallery in New York in September last year, and it was very well received. So I'm going to show you two other machines that work in a similar principle. They're all driven by this hand motion. They're like old style music boxes. So you can hear the voice has a because it's the pace of the person spinning, turning the wheel that determines the style. It's like a tape, an old reel effect. So that was the six singers. Can you play the red and green singer, please? Maybe we'll just leave it at that. Piano.
Okay.
And then the last piece is the drum machine, that music machine. So before you play it, William called me at the end of last year to say, oh, by the way, we sold the drum machine. And I said, who would buy something like this? And when you hear it, you'll understand my question. It now lives in Vedanta Nureyev's old apartment in the Dakota building in New York. Okay. And apparently the person, I don't know who bought it, but the person who now lives with it has it in their kitchen. I can't imagine hearing this. What the machine is doing is reading a score that I wrote for each of the parts, so each of the bits of the drum machine are reading their own parts on paper, and William's engineers had the paper music talk to the computer that runs the action, the solenoid that hits.
Note to end on, and we're going to open it because we've got some extra time. We're going to open it to some questions. Please just try and keep them brief because we are running over time. But I thought it was worth us seeing all three of those videos. So please.
Yeah.
Yes.
How were those voices created that came out of those
groups? I wrote the piece as a madrigal for six singers, yeah. And in fact, I went as far as auditioning and hiring six singers, and we did a version which came out okay. But then William said, "Well, why don't you try it with just your voice?" So I then sang all the six parts myself, and we decided that was the version we liked. So these are all my voice,
yeah.
Singing the soprano, singing the alto, and singing the tenor and the bass.
And how do you transfer that from a box into the piece?
They're just normal sound recordings that we did in the studio,
okay.
And then each of the machines, each of the singer machines, has a computer unit inside that reads the sound file.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, in the back. Sorry,
there's one here.
There was one hand in the room. Yes.
How much did the Americans have to pay for this?
I think it was. I'm not going to say it now, but I think it's probably a lot of money. It's William Kentridge. What can you say?
And Naomi Younger. Two hands over here, hand back. Lady with the pink. Yes. finish up.
I'll try. Firstly, thank you. It's all been totally fascinating.
Thank you.
I just want to know, where are you going? Can, are there opportunities to hear and see you here in Cape Town in the near future?
This year is committed to finishing the opera, and the opera will have a showcase in June in the US. The strange thing about being here and making opera is we can't really afford it. So it goes to the US after that. And only then do we hope to raise money through that process and bring it back home. So that's the one thing I'll do. I'm working on a few other projects. In May, I'm doing a project at Spear, the Dancing in Other Words Poetry Festival. So I'll have my band of associates there, and we'll perform with some world-renowned poets. It's curated, it's not curated by Breton Breitenbach. So that's the second week of May. I will be doing the writing of the new libretto in Joburg towards the end of the year. So there'll be concerts kind of in and out as we go. I'm not sure. I'm signed on to play outside. It's all out of the country, actually. I'll be away again in July. I don't have a live gig coming up in the next few weeks, but I have a website, neosong.net. And I do put notices there when things come up.
Neosong.net. Yes. There were two hands, gentlemen over, back, and you next. So, yes.
I'd like to ask you to share with us whatever you can about the 1 hour in the life of the opera, what direction it's going, what the main messages of the opera.
My focus is on the meaning of the man. I was very lucky. I was able to interact with him as a young journalist. I told the story of being a journalist at 702. What I didn't say was, this was the time, you know, the whole story around the juniorization of the newsroom. I was one of those juniors. So because I'd signed up to work in the mornings, all news happens in the mornings. Nothing happens in the afternoon or in the evening. So
the opening of Parliament happens at 7 p.m. So
that's not news.
Nothing
happens there that's newsworthy. I've tried to find ways to interrogate the meaning of Mandela. So the idea of Mandela as the peacemaker, Mandela as the fighter, Mandela as the missing father, Mandela as the lonely man at home. I've taken kind of archive material of that story and put it into the libretto. But inside of questions that are delivered by a cast that performs opposite him during this 1 hour, when he's lost, the people in the community ask and reveal some of these issues and some of the psychology of the man. But the theme for me is what does this life, what does this legacy mean for those of us who remain? What is there for us to do? Because that's the only point to have a Mandela story. He's written all the other stuff, and he's done all that other stuff. The question is how we activate these parts within us. And in fact, this is an ask that he has. He writes in a lot of his texts that we all have a light within, and one shouldn't be shy or nervous about illustrating that. And that is the way of freedom.
Sorry, Sam. I want to know about, you mentioned about your father, your mother, who support you. What about the community and your cousin and so on? Because I can see the road was not easy for you. And also I can see you are a hard worker and professional. I want to know what are the journey to become a professional, where you get the support to become a professional.
The family plays a huge role. In fact, when I speak about my mother and my father, usually I'm speaking in kind of a generic sense of my aunts, my uncles, and the support structure that we have in the home. It's a quite tight family in that sense. My community, in my street in Soweto, in Mufulo South,
yes,
there are not many people who've been able to make many things of their life. I come from a generation that you know, when I was beaten by the police, at the same time, five or six other people were beaten. One of those now has permanent brain damage. Lots of other people didn't finish school necessarily. Yes. So I come from a space where everybody looks at me as an example of how they could have been. And so we talk and we, so they, in a way, it's a short conversation, but we always have it. Okay. How are you? How are things? How's the music? And then everybody always says, oh, you know, we're very proud to see you on television. Everybody always says on television, yeah, he's from our street, he's from our street. So I still have that very strongly. And it's a very safe environment for me because our family knows everyone and everyone knows our family. So that's still, when I go home every other month. So when I see the old folks, it's still very, very strong. We don't have an everyday conversation relationship,
okay. Yeah.
But there is a strong connection.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay,
just two questions. One last question, yeah.
The instrument that you spoke about, the
mela
or the
mela,
do you still get it and where?
You do find them in Mozambique. Timbila for plural. You still get them in Mozambique.
You play with your hands.
You play with mallets. Mm-hmm. It looks like a rudimentary marimba. Mm-hmm. And people usually play it on the ground. They have one leg that is wrapped around an arm. And they play it in orchestras. Usually it's played by a combination of at least 21 people. Soprano voice, alto voice, tenor. And so you still find lots of Timbila orchestras in Mozambique. And here at the UCT College of Music, there are some guest lecturers that teach it. And there are specimens that you can find also.
Okay, so the other question, is the group of singers that you're at, you're in our street in Cape Town, do you still have them?
The choir, this is the choral project. Oh, wow, okay. That was a project that did, it was a project, one, to collect people who were told as children never to sing because they sound awful. So it was a choir of non-singers. And we rehearsed on Wednesday afternoons at the Unitarian Church on Holt Street in town. It's an old building that I never noticed until we started having rehearsals. It's a building that neighbors never noticed until we started making noise at lunch, and then they saw there was a church. So it was a project about making visible this old architecture that had become so invisible because it had just been there all the time. So we did that, but it took so much focus. I couldn't maintain it. But we did it for a year and a half.
Excellent. Well, sorry, I have to draw it to a close because otherwise we're going to be in deep trouble. But thank you very much for coming, and a special thank you to Neo, who is outstanding as usual. Thank you.